beep. Martin Luther King. Now, of course, he's extremely well known. I asked my daughter, my daughter's 24, she studied sciences, as to what she knew about Martin Luther King. She said, "I have a dream." Yeah, that was all, yeah? So, obviously, extremely well-known leader of the civil rights movement in America. But as we will see in this speech we're going to look at is the last one he ever made. He didn't know it was the last one. He was assassinated the next day. In this speech, we will see that he does not just suggest tactics and strategy to make progress against racist discrimination. He also refers to some other strategies which we don't usually associate with Martin Luther King. And one of them, we will see, one of them he rejects, and one of them he begins to accept in a rather surprising way. So I think that Martin Luther King, apart from being a very fine leader who did a lot of stuff, he is also a contribution to a huge debate which is continuing today. And this is the discussion, what can you do after the incredible trauma of slavery and the racism which stays? What can you do? And in the 20th century, in the 19th and 20th century, there have been many different ideas. For example, at the beginning of the 20th century, Marcus Garvey said, what is the solution? Back to Africa. Yeah? This is the solution. Back to Africa. He launched the Back to Africa movement. He said, we were kidnapped from Africa. We were taken from Africa. We didn't choose. So let's go back to Africa and make Africa great. And many thousands of people agreed with this. And a few hundred went back to Africa. And it turned, of course, in the modern economic world, this, from a practical point of view, it's not very realistic, but it shows one of the big ideas that was put forward. Later on, around Malcolm X and the Black Panthers, was the idea of black power. Yeah, black power, and we will be talking about that today. And today, in the Black Lives Matter movement, we see different events perhaps making a difference, demonstrations, but also riots. There have been riots around the United States when a historian says recently, they mean in the last 20 years. Yeah, we're always, yeah. A long time ago is before the year 1000. Yeah. So there have been riots after the killing of Mr. Floyd and in other situations, and the debate goes on. There is a debate that says, you know, some people say non-violence is the only successful tactic, and other people say no, riots can be useful. It's very, very difficult to prove one or the other. Very, very difficult, because when something happens, who knows what made a difference? Although I must admit, today, with the Black Lives Matter, it seems to me difficult to say that the riots made no difference. That seems a difficult position. But that's not about Martin Luther King. So let's go back to him. Here he is then, born in 1929, American Christian, minister, Baptist, activist and political philosopher. He was the son of a Baptist minister, Martin Luther King Sr. And interestingly enough, he was not baptized Martin Luther King. He was baptized Michael King. And later on, his father said, when he was 28 years old, his father said, you're going to change your name. Now, you're like, what, 21 or something? And if your father said, we're going to change your name, yeah, this was the old days. He said, yes, Daddy. So he changed his name to Martin Luther King, obviously in homage to Martin Luther, the German, well, there wasn't Germany at the time, but the theologian who was going to transform the Christian religion by defeating the Catholic Church and successfully establishing Protestantism. So, a big deal, yeah. So he was named after this Christian reformer. He became well known for participating in and leading marches for the right to vote, for desegregation, but also for trade union rights. He worked in a series of support for strikes, especially of black workers. He was also president of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. I will come to that. His most famous intervention is the 1963 March on Washington, where he delivers his I Have a Dream speech on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial. And he was also involved in the marches in Selma. And a few years ago, I think 5 years ago, it might be 10, there was a film made, Selma, that's the title of the film, and I highly recommend it. It goes into detail about what were things were like. You can see Martin Luther King if you're lucky enough to go to Washington, D.C. And here you have the statue of Martin Luther King. It's a bit of a theme this semester, massive statues. So you can see that he is not carved into Mount Rushmore, but nevertheless he's kind of coming, he's in the rock. So this is a kind of symbol, you know, the rock, the solidity. It's also extremely white. It's white rock, which is an interesting idea. Obviously, supposed to be extremely powerful, indignant, and, you know, I guess effective. But there is another piece of important information about this statue, which I have on the next slide. And that was that it was, this is the same statue, that is that it was erected in 2011. Yeah, he was killed in 1968 and it was erected in 2011. This is not an accident, of course. Yeah, 10 years later, there was not enough consensus for a big statue like that. 20 years later, there was not enough consensus. It's 40 years later. Yeah? So, you know, a long, long time, a whole generation. Difference there. Martin Luther King is, of course, well known around the world, and you can also see a statue of him in some places you might not think. Westminster Abbey. In Westminster Abbey in London, in 1998, so 30 years after his assassination, there you have Martin Luther King. Westminster Abbey, then the most important church in London, although it is not a cathedral. There are four cathedrals in London, and Westminster Abbey is not one of them. You don't care, do you? Well, it's not very important. There you go. But the interesting thing about him is that Westminster Abbey is an Anglican abbey. And here we have a statue of Martin Luther King, who's a Baptist. Normally, Anglicans are supposed to hate Baptists because, you know how people are nearly the same. They can be a lot of tension. I don't mean they really hate Baptists, but it's very different. You don't usually have statues of people who are from another kind of religion in your church. So he obviously made a bit of progress there. I think he's going to fall over, actually. He looked like he's going to fall over. Okay, so Westminster Abbey, and indeed also in I will come to France in a moment. No doubt the two changes in the law which are most associated with Martin Luther King are the Civil Rights Act in 1964, which was passed under the presidents of Kennedy, although it has to be said that Kennedy was not in a hurry. Yeah. He slowly decided to support the Civil Rights Act, under pressure from the movement. Yeah, so the movement was big, and eventually Kennedy agreed. This is the Civil Rights Act, which declares no segregation is possible in public places and no discrimination in employment. Now, as we know, when you pass a law, this does not end discrimination, but it does help. So this is often associated with Martin Luther King because it was at the moment when he was organizing the biggest movements. But there were also riots, there were also other movements, there were many things going on. There was a political consideration inside the Democratic Party and so on. And the other law which is associated with him is the Voting Rights Act of 1965. And the Voting Rights Act of 1965 tried to stop, and was quite successful in stopping, special rules which were intended to stop black people voting. I will talk about these in a moment. They're very important. He was sent to jail a number of times, and you can read his autobiography if you want to. I bought his autobiography when I was preparing this class, but I haven't read it, so I don't know what is in it. But I think it must be pretty good. He became very much a symbol of political activity, and so you can see him over the years on a number of badges. You can see here the March on Washington in 1963, and the other ones with his name on, often produced, this one produced then after his death, Don't Let the Dream Die. You notice on this badge they don't even put his name. They say everybody knows who it is. You don't need to put his name on it. So these are badges, of course, that you wear on your clothes. So he became an important symbol. And indeed, when he was assassinated, he was an internationally known figure. And only 4 days after his assassination, there was a big meeting in Paris. Hommage au prestigieux combattant antiraciste, prix Nobel de la paix. Au cercle d'hiver, maître fille du calvaire, mais si vous préférez la ligne 9, vous descendez à Oberkampf, vous descendez par là, ça marche aussi. Okay, so he was an international figure by the time that he was killed, and he was, as it says here, he got the Nobel Peace Prize. He received the Nobel Peace Prize in 1964 and went to Norway to give a speech there. And indeed, you can find a number of his speeches on YouTube if you're not too busy, and they're pretty powerful things. After his death, there was... first of all, in just a few cities and a few states, the celebration of Martin Luther King Day, but this was made into a national federal holiday in the 1980s, so 12 or 13 years later. And this is an interesting poster, because as you can see, it's actually a template. It's not a poster, it's a template for a poster. You are supposed to take it and complete it. So instead of your city hall, it's, you know, Hôtel de Ville Mont-Saint-Aignan, and instead of your company, it's, you know, the University of Rouen, and this is what is recommended, you know, that there should be rides for the children, yeah, merry-go-rounds and so on, market stalls, music. So it's become something which is, I wouldn't say anything against it, becomes something less directly political. And you can see here then a poster, yeah, Happy MLK Day. I have a dream. Now, I need to go back into the history of racism in the United States to give the context of the movements that King was involved with. And you really need to go back to the end of slavery, the Civil War, victory by the North. Oh, sorry, there you have Martin Luther King with his Nobel Peace Prize. The Civil War, victory by the North, and then opens up a period, perhaps you remember, what's the name of the period just after the war, just after the Civil War? Begins with an R. Yes. Thank you, yes, Reconstruction, that's fairly easy to understand. It was partly about literally reconstructing the South. A lot of the towns were damaged, reorganizing society, because they had a few million freed slaves. A lot of them immediately moved north because it just felt safer. But of course, many could not move north. And this is the period of Reconstruction, which had some success, but also came up against enormous resistance. So segregation, which we're going to talk about in a moment, was the product of the reimposition of white supremacy after the failure of Reconstruction. So the Reconstruction was about the rights of freed slaves, but also about social policy and so on. What happened in the Reconstruction period? Well, you got the 14th Amendment, in which blacks were given citizenship, and the 15th Amendment gave black people the right to vote. Sorry, black men. Was it black men? Yes, black men the right to vote. So this is the moment of reconstruction. However, this was also the moment of a tremendous building of white resistance in the South. This is the time when the Ku Klux Klan became very, very powerful. A terrifying terrorist organization, really, because the whole idea is you don't know who it is. They come in the middle of the night. They use symbols, the burning cross. So it's terrorism in the original form. That of course they kill a lot of people, but the most important thing is to make millions of people terrified. And in the 1860s, in the 1870s, the Supreme Court supported a lot of the white resistance by changing the interpretations of the 14th and 15th Amendment. For example, in saying it is okay to have a literacy test. For in many states in the South, everybody had the right to vote, or all the men had the right to vote, but in fact you were only allowed to vote if you could pass an exam, a literacy. So that was one big thing, and of course the exam was, the real intention was to stop black people voting, but it was illegal to say this is to stop black people voting. In some states they also had a grandfather clause. That is to say, they said you can vote if you can pass this literacy test, or if you can prove that your grandfather was a voter. Yeah, so the white people, yeah. So there were 100 ways of establishing that black people would not vote, despite the fact that in theory this was not possible. The end of Reconstruction is generally dated at 1877, when the Northern soldiers were withdrawn from the South. The Northern soldiers were withdrawn from the South, and so the South was no longer occupied militarily. White supremacy was restored in the South. As I mentioned, blacks lost the right to vote, and the Democratic Party became the dominant party in the South. And now this appears to us today to be a little bit unusual, because today in America, in my opinion, there is not really a left-wing party. But if you know a left-wing American in a party, they are in the Democratic Party. They are never in the Republican Party. But at this time, the Democratic Party was the main supporter of segregation. And indeed, in 1896, the Supreme Court declared segregation is okay. Segregation is not constitutional. And they said that if white and black people have separate but equal facilities, yes, 1896. Yeah, it's these dates when they go fast. Yeah, 1896. This is Plessy versus Ferguson. Perhaps you know that in the Supreme Court we always call the decisions, you know, Smith versus Jones, etc. Yes, and so they said if segregated facilities are separate but equal, it's okay. Now, as you can imagine, this idea that they were separate but equal was completely untrue. If you went to in the 50s or the 60s, if you went to a shopping centre, then there were white toilets in the shopping centre and black toilets behind the car park behind. Yeah, segregation was really just a code word for white supremacy. Now, that is the end of the 19th century. I'm going to jump forward a few decades, but we have to try perhaps to keep in mind that people had to live through these decades. You know, it's like 10 years, nothing's changed. 20 years, nothing's changed. 30 years, nothing's changed. You know, you can imagine the weight of the defeats of the past in the minds of people who were against segregation in the South. World War II made a big difference. First of all, because World War II was sold in America as a fight against Hitler's racist ideas. And so it became more complicated for the racist system to defend racist ideas. The army was still segregated. When the United States Army came to Europe, you joined a black battalion or a white battalion. They were separate. They had some problems in England because the local authorities and the pubs and so on refused to separate. and there's sometimes big conflicts about this. And so after the Second World War, there were slow moves towards desegregation. In 1948, the army was desegregated. After 1948, the battalions were mixed. And the other thing I asked my students in the last group, and I realized that people don't know. So in this time when Martin Luther King is beginning to fight, 1953, 1954, how many black people were in America, do you think? Would you like to guess? It's all right. In the other class, everybody was wrong, so there is no shame. Would you like to guess how many?
Yeah?
50 million. Okay, that's interesting. Anybody more or less? Less. Okay, but in fact, you're actually quite close. It's 20 million. But in the other class, they said 500,000. And nobody said anything against it. So yeah, we're talking about 20 million, which is an enormous number of people. I think that's important to remember because sometimes a fight, in Europe, We are used to a fight against racism, which is in the direct interests of 2%, 3% of the population. Yeah, in Europe, usually anti-racist policies are not about 10%, 15% of the population. They're about the smaller groups. Okay, so 20 million. Now, very slowly things moved forward, and in 1954, a new Supreme Court decision declared that segregation was, I quote, inherently unequal. This is the Brown decision, 1954. So in 1896, the Supreme Court said segregation is okay. And in 1954, faut attendre 58 ans quand même. Il y a des gens qui l'ont attendu. Okay, so in 1954, it was no, segregation is racist and therefore against the Constitution. But they had a big problem because, of course, you can change the law, but there was no intention in the South of applying the law. In particular, the Supreme Court said that desegregation should be carried out with all deliberate speed. That is that schools must be integrated. Restaurants must be integrated. This did not happen in the South. Yes?
Should be carried out.
Quotation. With all deliberate speed. Alors, c'est un sens un peu spécial de deliberate. C'est aussi vite que raisonnablement possible. Quelque chose comme ça. With all deliberate speed. Yes. Now, in fact, this turned out to be very difficult. And I will just mention the example of schools. Fairly well, perhaps you've heard of the Little Rock case, but I've just been reading about it, and it's more impressive than you think. They declared then that schools, but the problem was, when they declared that schools should be integrated, in fact, in the place we're going to look at in Little Rock, the state governor was opposed, all the teachers were opposed, and 75% of the white students were opposed. And so it was very, very difficult. And the story of the Little Rock Nine, where a decision was made that nine volunteer black students were going to be allowed to go to the prestigious Central High School in Little Rock. And this is the memoirs of one of them that I'm reading at the moment. I highly recommend. Although, yeah, if you're a man, read it on your own, because you're not supposed to cry in public. Yeah, okay, a really excellent book. They had nine children going to school, and eventually the president sent 1,200 soldiers to protect them. They needed 1,000 soldiers to protect these nine children, and they really did need them. It was very surprising that none of them were murdered. Inside the school, she tells the story that she was being kicked every day, and the soldiers didn't stop that. In the toilets, the white girls set fire to her hair. It was really extreme. I don't want to give you all the gore, but it's really, I have 50 years political experience, and I'm shocked reading this book. So really, a very, very solid Ku Klux Klan type of mentality, and she was 15 years old. But they didn't give up because they understood, even though they were 15, they understood that these nine Yeah, if they didn't stay, then the battle would be lost. Outside the school, there were 2,000 white people chanting, "We want to kill you." I prefer my life. It was much, much quieter than that. I was just in the library reading science fiction books. Okay, so that's the situation when we arrive at the first big action, well-known action by Martin Luther King, which is the Montgomery bus boycott, which you have heard. I think you've heard of, vaguely, of the Montgomery bus boycott. Oh, that's excellent. That's good. And you remember, that's good. That's great. Okay. Well, tell me if I make any mistakes. I'm sure I won't. So this is the first thing. Now, what actually happened was that Martin Luther King moved to Montgomery. But first of all, let me go to Martin Luther King and give you a little bit about his upbringing. He was born in 1929 in Atlanta. His father was a Baptist minister. This is where he lived when he was a child. Photos are always important, because when you see this is where he lived with his child, you can see that they were not a poor family. I don't mean that they weren't rich, but this is not a poor family's house in the 1940s, in the 1950s. And he tells in his autobiography some sad stories in the 30s. In 1935, he was very young, and his best friend was a white boy who lived in the same street. But when he was 6, the white boy's parents said, "You must not play with the black boy anymore." And they went to separate schools. And he said that. So this is how he learned about this. When he went to high school, he went to a high school named after the African-American educator Booker T. Washington. And in high school, he became quite well known as a public speaker. They used to have public speak. Do they still do this in high schools in France? Do you have debating societies? Well, this is a big thing. Is it Concours d'éloquence? Not really. Yeah, not very often. Yeah. In England, this is a big thing. Debating societies. Yeah. He discovered the horrors of segregation and having to stand up in the bus because there was only room for the white people to sit down, etc. Because not only was segregation really just another word for white supremacy, it's also the idea is daily humiliation, being humiliated every day. This is how it's supposed to work. When he was 15. He had jumped a class or two, and he had decided that he was going to become a minister. He hadn't decided yet. He was going to go to university to study religion. But he spent a summer working in a farm in the north. And this was the first time he'd been to the north where there was no segregation. And he wrote to his father, "After we passed Washington, there was no discrimination at all. The white people here are very nice. We are allowed to go to the finest restaurant, and blacks and whites go to the same church." So he decides to become a minister, a religious minister, and he gets a Bachelor of Divinity degree in 1951. While he's at university, he falls in love with the daughter of a German woman, so a white woman. But the pressure is too much, and even his father says, "Yeah, if you marry a white woman, you won't get a job in the Black Baptist churches. You won't get a ministry, and also you will get a lot of hostility from the white people." And so he gave up the idea of marrying her. And according to one of his friends, he never recovered. He then took a doctorate in theology, and at the age of 25, he moved to Montgomery, Alabama. So this is quite a long way from Atlanta, Georgia. I don't know how far, but it's quite a long way. So here he is. And I think that is, because I know that you're approximately 21 years old. And so it's kind of interesting to think, when he led the Montgomery bus boycott, he was 26. It's like, you know, his wife, Coretta Scott, was also going to get very much involved in the movement for civil rights. Why don't we have his church here now? Okay. So what happened in the Montgomery bus boycott? Well, some of it is...
what's the name of his wife?
Coretta. Coretta. Nice name, isn't it? Coretta. She was Coretta Scott, and then Coretta Scott King. And indeed, we will see later, she continues his work after he dies. She continues to be a civil rights leader. Well, there she is. Not a very good photograph, but there you go. As I'm sure you heard, a couple of people got refused to stand up so that white people could sit down in the buses, and the most well known being Rosa Parks. Here she is with Martin Luther King. That's Martin Luther King behind, and she's become, of course, very well known indeed. And you can find on Amazon France, an important research site, you can see a couple of children's books about Rosa Parks. So that's how well known she was. So once Rosa Parks was arrested, and there was a lot of anger around this, they had a meeting of all the black ministers, all the black priests, Baptist priests of the town, to decide what to do. And they decided to organise the bus boycott. So the interesting thing about this is that normally if you think, oh yes, organised bus boycott against racism, you think, oh, perhaps a political party organised it, or perhaps the trade unions organised it. Absolutely not, because the political parties were not against segregation, the big ones, the Democrats and the Republicans. The trade unions, many of the trade unions, didn't want black members. And so it was not surprising that the churches organized the boycott. And indeed, one of the commentators at the time, one of the black commentators at the time, said, "Christianity is the only thing which white America has left us." And so we shouldn't be too surprised, but it's very, very important that religion was at the centre of the movement, and also of Martin Luther King's life. Because we live in France and we're very, 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 very laic, we sometimes think, oh yes, Martin Luther King was a political leader who happened to be a bit religious. That's absolutely false. Religion was at the very centre of all his activity from the beginning of his life to the end. That doesn't mean that he didn't change ideas about how to win. So, for example, he would use vocabulary like, what are we doing in the anti-racist movement? We are cleansing the soul of America. Nous voulons nettoyer l'âme de l'Amérique. Yeah, we're cleansing the soul of America. So very, very moral language. And also he will speak as... He will use biblical language, and indeed, in the speech that we're looking at today, he talks about going to the mountaintop. I have been to the mountaintop. Very good. You've been to the mountaintop. Qu'est-ce qu'il fait là? Il raconte ses vacances d'été. Yeah, I went to the mountaintop. We had a good picnic, and then we had a little hike. What on earth? Why is he going to the mountaintop? Now, this is where it's a slight disadvantage not to have a religious upbringing. Who went to the mountaintop before Martin Luther King? Did anybody have a religious upbringing? Am I the only one? Oh, you missed on something wonderful there. Any idea?
Moses.
Absolutely correct. Moses went to the mountaintop, yes. Moses went to the mountaintop. This is when the Jews have been liberated from Egypt and slavery, yeah, and they are wandering around looking for somewhere to live. There's a joke about Moses here. Why did it take Moses 40 years to lead the Jews to the promised land? Because he was a man and he wouldn't ask anybody for help. Okay, just a little feminist joke there. Okay. With no connection with Martin Luther King. So Moses went to the mountaintop. Okay. What did he have when he came down from the mountain? He came down with a laptop. No, not a laptop. What did he come down with? Yes.
Did he have the commandments?
He did. He had the Ten Commandments. You know, thou shalt not kill, thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's wife, thou shalt not listen to rap. No, that one wasn't in there. Okay, the Ten Commandments. So when Martin Luther King says, I have been to the mountaintop, It's not a very modest thing to say. It says, I have been to talk to God, and I've come back to tell you what God said. Okay, it's not modest. So he's believing that he has a mission from God and a message from God, which is, I think, what he did believe. And indeed, at the beginning of this speech, you don't see it in the text. But if you listen to the video, they introduce him. And now you can listen to Martin Luther King, the Moses of 1968. Après, il faut le porter comme surnom. Yeah? Okay, it's a pretty ambitious thing. Yes, so the religious vocabulary, extremely important, and I will come back to that. So this bus boycott continued for more than a year. And it's not a small town. A lot of people had to walk a long way. And so they'd chosen this boycott. Now, the origin of the word boycott is Irish. In the 19th century in Ireland, you had the first boycott, which was when landlords would expel poor people from their lands because they couldn't pay the rents. Then everybody in the region refused to work for this landlord, and so their crops could not be collected. This was a boycott, yeah? They decided on the boycott, and of course it's quite complicated to call a campaign, but what is especially complicated is sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't work. So on the Monday morning, all the churches on the Sunday, the pastor said, "Do not take the buses. Do not take the buses anymore because they treat our people badly." But of course, on Monday, Martin Luther King didn't sleep well because sometimes you ask people to do this and nobody does it. But he was lucky. It was a great success, and it lasted for more than a year. For more than a year, the black people did not take the buses, taxi drivers would give free rides. Of course, most people walked, but there were also taxi drivers, carpooling, and so on. And so this is a good example, I think, of Martin Luther King's idea for nonviolent action, which also means everybody is involved. When you have to walk because you refuse to be humiliated, then you are personally involved. It changes people. So it's about everybody getting involved, not saying, "Oh well, I will vote for somebody and they will change things." And so this is part of, although we often concentrate on the idea that Martin Luther King did not like violence, he was also very much in favour of mass activity and everybody getting involved. And his hero was Gandhi. Who I can't talk about much at the moment. 385 days it lasted. And the result was the district court, so that's the federal court locally, declared that Montgomery buses must be mixed, must be desegregated. So this was actually a campaign against an illegal activity. Segregation was already illegal after this Supreme Court decision, but this was the what was needed to make things happen. And here you have quite a recent monument. This is a recent monument, and this is a monument to the bus boycott. And these are people walking. They're just walking because they're refusing to take the bus. Very, very 21st century style there. This is the church in Montgomery where very very standard Southern church, Southern Baptist church architecture. This is the church where he went. I should say this is the first time I've given this class on Martin Luther King. I discovered all this last month, and the next best known thing what he did is shown in this poster, because with a group of other civil rights activists, in particular other Baptist pastors, they formed a new organization, the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. Now, this is not a conference in the normal sense of un congrès. This is it's like une commission, si vous voulez, une commission de la direction des chrétiens du Sud. This is a rather surprising title, if you like. They could have called it, organization against discrimination. Yeah, the movement for civil rights. No, the Southern Christian. So obviously, Christianity, religion is at the centre. And here you have just one of their meetings. Now, I don't have the exact date here. Wednesday, December the 10th. Admission free. And this is Dr. King will autograph his great book, his first book, Stride Towards Freedom. By this time, the Montgomery boycott made Martin Luther King into a national figure. Everybody knew who he was. So he has the. Of course, you notice immediately that the meeting happens in a church. So again, we're not missing the religious side of this. It's at 8 o'clock at night, and you have 1, 2, 3, 4 speakers. All of them are reverend. Yes, they're all religious preachers. They're all religious people. I don't know if they are all black. It may be that there's one white one. That's possible. There was one more thing. Oh, and notice that it's not just speeches. It's also organisation reports from Tuskegee, Norfolk, Little Rock, Shreveport, Mississippi. So the local reports. What is happening in your town? What is happening in your town? What can we do to help? So both organisation and inspirational in style. Now the Southern Christian Leadership Conference will be led by Martin Luther King for 10 or 12 years until he dies in 1968. But it will continue after that, and you have here a magazine of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference from 1971. A couple of things to notice about it. First of all, the title of the paper, Soul Force. Yeah, La Force de l'Âme. You were staying with this spirituality thing. I don't know anything more about particularly what's in this. Although I think I already mentioned to you, a movement without a newspaper is not really a movement. Before the internet. Yeah, you can get away without one these days. The first event of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference was the 1957 Prayer Pilgrimage for Freedom. Okay, Prayer Pilgrimage for Freedom. Yeah, so you've seen every time how central religion is. Le pèlerinage de prière pour la liberté. Okay, very, very, very clear here. Now, the FBI was rather worried. This is the period of the Cold War and the period of McCarthyism, and the FBI in the next few years began to record all of Martin Luther King's telephone conversations, and they were looking for, was he a secret communist? That's what they were looking for. They did not find any evidence of this because he was not a secret communist, okay, but they did find other things they used against him. For example, they found that he had at one point a relationship with another woman, and they made sure it appeared in the newspapers because they were hoping that that his power could be reduced by attacks on his private life. The next importance. Set of movement. Now, Martin Luther King was involved in 20 different movements or 20 different big events, and I'm not going to talk about 20 of them. It's too many. So the next big one in 1960 that I want to talk about is the Atlanta sit-ins. Now, these were in fact not organized originally by Martin Luther King. You can see two examples here. Here you have four black young people sitting in the white part of the restaurant. And what will happen is they will sit there all day and the staff will refuse to serve them because they're in the white part of the restaurant. They are appearing to be quite calm, but here you can see other ones and they are being attacked by racists and pouring beer over their heads and so on. A lot of people were injured in these sit-ins. So again, what they were trying to do was to impose the law. The Supreme Court had decided that segregation was illegal, but things were not changing. And in August, the Atlanta sit-ins began in March, and in August they sent a letter to Dr. King and said, would you like to join us? Because they knew that if Martin Luther King was arrested, it would be in all the newspapers across the country. And so he did, and he was arrested. a lot of people were arrested. Now, the interesting thing is that Martin Luther King joined the sit-in at a restaurant inside a department store in Atlanta. And the seats and the bar from this restaurant 10 years later were bought by the National Museum for African American History in Washington, and they took them to Washington, and you can see them in the museum, the real ones, where it's very very impressive. If you're ever lucky enough to go to Washington DC, it's the most incredible museum. Yeah, has anybody been to Washington DC? Did you go to the museum? It's pretty good, huh? It's quite recent. It's only about 10 years old, isn't it? It's only about 10 years old. Yeah, it's 10 or 15 years old, I think, the museum. It's a very modern building. Yeah, very modern building, yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. Oh, that must have been quite an experience, yeah, yeah. I'm old, I've been everywhere. But you're young, you should go places. That's not true. I've never been to China or Russia. So in any case, King was arrested and all the others were released. All the other prisoners were released except King. And King was came up in front of a very harsh judge who sentenced him to 4 months of hard labor. Rather a bad political tactic because this caused a national scandal. Here he is having been arrested. This caused a national scandal, and in fact, this was shortly before the 1960 presidential election, and so the two presidential candidates were asked to make a statement, and Richard Nixon, the Republican, who previously had an okay relationship with King, says, "No, I have nothing to say." Because this was election time, yeah, they were calculating. Whereas Kennedy got involved, and King was released two days later. So this was the time when it appeared that Kennedy was better than the others, without being brilliant. Yeah, it was better than the others. 1 year after the first sit-ins, a deal was made with the local authorities, that all the restaurants in the city would be desegregated. And so again, here you had a successful campaign, even though a lot of people were injured. It was a successful campaign, and eventually the law was applied. Now I have too many there. Let's jump forward 3 years to the Birmingham campaign in 1963. In April 1963, the Southern Christian Leadership Council Conference began a campaign against racial segregation and economic injustice in Birmingham. And they wanted to cause a lot of trouble. And Martin Luther King used a similar slogan to the slogans used by Gandhi in his campaign against British domination in India. He said, "Let's fill the prisons." Yeah. They could arrest 100 people. Can they arrest 1,000 people? Can they arrest 5,000 people? Let's see. And this would fill the prisons. This was the idea. After a couple of weeks, Martin Luther King was not sure about this idea, but the committee decided, let's have a children's demonstration. And so they had a demonstration only made up of children and young adults. Newsweek called this the Children's Crusade. The police attacked the children with high-pressure water jets and police dogs. These attacks, broadcast on national television, shocked many people across the country. The police being led by the notorious Bull O'Connor. He was the police chief at the time. He was arrested. Martin Luther King was arrested again, and from his cell, he wrote the quite well known letter from Birmingham Jail, which is an important historical document. But we didn't choose that one. We chose his last speech to put in here. But I have a couple of quotations here from the letter from Birmingham Jail. Reminds me of the Ballad of Reading Jail by Oscar Wilde. So the first thing he says, we know through painful experience that freedom is never voluntarily given by the oppressor. It must be demanded by the oppressed. And so I think, as I say, the fact that Martin Luther King didn't like violence is well known, but I think it's important to remember that he believed that you know, in action. And the second one, this is a slightly more radical, if you like, he says in the same document, I have almost reached the regrettable conclusion that the Negro's greatest obstacle in his stride towards freedom is not the Ku Klux Klanner, it is the white moderate. The white moderate is more devoted to order than to justice. The white moderate prefers a negative peace, which is the absence of tension, to a positive peace, which is the presence of justice. The same year, the March on Washington will be the moment when King gives his most well-known speech, the I Have a Dream speech, and here is the speakers in front of the Who's the guy behind them? Yes, this is the Lincoln Memorial in Washington. There's also like a million steps in front of it. Well, not quite a million, a lot of steps in front of it. And as you can see, although King is important, he's not the only one by a long way. And I think there's one white guy there. And this is where he gives his I Have a Dream speech. There are a couple of debates going on at this moment. One of them is around one of his allies. But let's first of all look at the program. Here we have the program. The Lincoln Memorial Program. You can't read it all. It doesn't matter. August the 28th, 1963. Notice that although there are now a number of different movements for civil rights, the centrality of religion in the South is still very much present. So you can see that the program ends with a benediction and begins with a speech by the Archbishop of Washington. Otherwise, we have various religious people, the National Council of Churches of Christ. But also the president of the American Jewish Congress. But also a number of non-religious people. For example, trade union leaders, number 7, Walter Reuter, a trade union leader. Number 6, the leader of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. It's a new organization, not particularly Christian. Here you have some of the things going on. The other important thing to notice here is they begin with the national anthem. Okay, yeah, we're not anti-American. Look at us, we're beginning with the national anthem. We see this in many political movements since. I'm sure you remember a few years ago the movement in France of the Gilets Jaunes, and they often used the French flag. So this idea of left patriotism, if you like, it has a future. They had a couple of difficulties. They had a million difficulties. There are always lots of difficulties. Nothing is ever easy. At one point, Martin Luther King was very much in what we would call today a burnout. He was exhausted. During the Montgomery campaign, his house was bombed. A few times he was almost killed by a bomb. So you can imagine that psychologically this is pretty hard. And there was at one point somebody, one of his committee said, well, you know, perhaps you should see a psychologist and get some support. And they decided that this was not possible because the FBI would know and it would be in all the newspapers. You know, Martin Luther King is mad. Also, this is the 1960s. Yeah, people were very, very old-fashioned about the idea of getting therapy or psychological help. Yeah, you know, people of my father's generation who thought, yeah, psychologists are for mad people. So that's an interesting personal side of this. But the other difficulty that they had at this time, which wasn't his fault, was the controversy about one of their leaders, Bayard Rustin. Now, there has been recently a series on Netflix or Amazon, I'm not sure, about Bayard Rustin. He was one of the leaders, one of the organizers of the march, and he was homosexual, and everybody knew it, and he didn't hide it. But of course, this was this appeared to be a political problem, and so they obliged Martin Luther King to, you know, don't talk about him. So basically, Martin Luther King continued to work with him and to defend him in private, was not seen too much in public with him. That was the compromise that they came up with. Now, this march to Washington, march on Washington, the President Kennedy, who'd been elected, I think, in 1960, was the first president I remember. Not very much. I just I was four. Initially, he was against the march. Yeah, so Martin Luther King and all his allies organized it with the Jewish Coalition and other people organized this march on Washington for civil rights and action on poverty. Initially the president didn't like the idea. He said, "Hey, I'm president, you're marching on Washington. I don't like this idea very much." Yeah? Eventually he realized it was going to happen. So Kennedy supported the march, and in response, the organizers of the march toned down a little bit. The speeches were not going to be against the president, even though the president was moving very, very slowly on civil rights. But as a result, the march was criticized from the left. So Malcolm X, a more radical black leader, said, "It's not a march on Washington, it's the farce on Washington." And he said, "We want to boycott this march, it's too moderate." Not unsurprisingly, you get endless discussions and conversations and disputes inside a movement. What is too moderate? What is too radical? These are extremely difficult questions in every movement. Yeah, because if you're too moderate, nothing happens. And if you're too radical, sometimes nothing happens. Yeah, so not easy. That's the I Have a Dream thingy. Let me move through a little bit more of this. Yes, let me just mention one of the other big debates going on at this time. Because although the first organizations to get national coverage were the Southern the Montgomery Boycott and the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, as the civil rights movement grew, then there were many different ideas about which way to go forward. And I already mentioned that during the 20th century there have been different ideas how to deal with the heritage of slavery. I mentioned Marcus Garvey and Back to Africa and the Black Power people. And inside the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, you get people like Sir Stokely Carmichael, who at the time was defending the slogan Black Power. Now, when Martin Luther King heard about this new slogan, Black Power, he was not so sure. And he wasn't against it, but it didn't seem to him to fit into his idea, which is very, very religious, yeah? How can we speak to our white brothers in Christ? Black Power. He met with Stokely Carmichael. They spent a few days. He wanted to be sure he understood everything. And so Martin Luther King never denounced the slogan Black Power, but he never used it. However, in this speech, as we will see in a moment, he began to take on some of the ideas coming from the Black Power idea. The Black Power current, if you like. When I'm talking about social history, I'm always very careful with the word movement. Personally, I only use the word movement if you have a group in every town, you're a movement. Otherwise, you're probably something like a network or a current. Yeah, and keep it down there. Okay. Big movement in Selma in 1965. Tremendous violence against the marches. In March 1965, and this is shown in the film Selma. But Martin Luther King was also involved in supporting different industrial union strikes, and I'll come to that in a moment. I hadn't finished talking about Stokely Carmichael. Yes, so Stokely Carmichael was originally the president of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, but his idea of nonviolence, which he will later abandon, was very different from Martin Luther King's. For Martin Luther King, nonviolence was a Christian principle. It was a way of life. For Stokely Carmichael, nonviolence was a tactic because it wins. And you can understand its attraction as a tactic, because if you say to young black people, go and fight with the police, that's rather stupid because they will lose. The police have more arms, they're stronger. Yeah, so let's go and fight with the police is not a very intelligent tactic. And so, for example, the boycotts, the bus boycotts and the sit-ins are non-violent tactics which were supported by many people who are not pacifists, who say, oh, no, never any violence. And so this debate will go on, and in particular, after the death of Martin Luther King, other organizations who were not based on non-violence began to get more influence. For example, the Black Panthers, who certainly were not based on non-violence, but had a lot of influence in the North. They organized free school meals, and they organized creches, and they also organized defense for political meetings. Now, King was involved in a number of other movements. There you can see one of the strikes that he was involved in leading. And here we have Selma, which I just mentioned a moment ago. And one of the last movements he was involved in was in Chicago in 1966. So Chicago is in the north, just at the bottom of Lake Michigan. Not on the Mississippi River, but on the other river. I discovered this yesterday. Okay, the Chicago. This was the Chicago housing movements, the Chicago open housing movements. And this is their slogan: "We're on the move to end slums." Now, slums is always a word which is difficult to translate into French, because you have different words in French. Because if you use the French word bidonville, you get the impression of a big area where people have built their own houses with what they can find. And a slum is not that. A slum is a part of town with very bad housing. But it's a part of town. It's that they are houses built in. Very often houses which 100 years ago were good houses and now are not. So the slums, il faut traduire quartier pauvre délabré, something like that. Yeah. Because bidonville is not going to do it in the town. So Chicago. So here we see Martin Luther King getting involved in movements which are not directly against racial discrimination, but include racial discrimination. Indeed, the problem of housing in Chicago was that the real estate agents were very racist, and as quite often they still are today, in fact, around the world, but worse. And so they organized, they tested different real estate agents, and then they had marches to the real estate agents to demand equal treatment to black people. And here you have Martin Luther King speaking to the president. This is Lyndon B. Johnson. Now, working in the North, King was very surprised in the North, because he had far more threats of murder threats and so on than he had in the South, strangely enough. Now, the last political question I want to look at is that the question of the Vietnam War, which was rising in strength during this time. And Martin Luther King had a bit of a problem, because he was saying, you know, we're against violence, and we're getting some help from the president, get for civil rights, a little help from the president. But how can we be against violence if we don't oppose the Vietnam War, which of course was extremely violent, and we know more about it today, that, you know, just mass bombing and massacre. For a little while he hesitated. He says, you know, if I oppose the Vietnam War, I will have to attack the president directly. This might not be good political tactics. Now, his wife was already involved in the movement against the Vietnam War, but eventually Martin Luther King decided then to join the movement against the Vietnam War. Here he is giving his speech. Well, this is one of the things he says. He's becoming more radical. The Black Revolution is much more than a struggle for the rights of Negroes. It is forcing America to face all its interrelated flaws, racism, poverty, militarism, and materialism. It is exposing evils that are rooted deeply in the whole structure of our society. It reveals systemic rather than superficial flaws and suggests that radical reconstruction of society itself is the real issue to be faced. So radical reconstruction of society itself, yeah, he's becoming a pretty radical person. However, opposing the Vietnam War was something new. He lost a lot of friends. A lot of his friends abandoned him at that point, yeah? One of the strange things about history is that today, if you watch films about the Vietnam War, it's all about how horrible it was. And if you come across the Vietnam War in the newspapers, it's about the movement against the Vietnam War. But of course, most Americans supported the Vietnam War. That's normal in wartime. And so we forget that. We just concentrate on the people against it. And so many, many friends abandoned him. His mental health suffered. And he lost a number of important allies, particularly President Johnson, were against him. The trade union leaders were supporting them. Strangely enough, Billy Graham. Now, Billy Graham was a very important Christian leader who had supported him and moved against him at this point. So terrible. He also had to work on the. He was a very sophisticated man. He looked at the tactics as well. He always thought about, you know, how can we win here? So he was a really sophisticated man. Here's one of the things he said about the civil rights movement and the peace movement. I have not urged a mechanical fusion of the civil rights and peace movements. There are people who have come to see the moral imperative of equality between black and whites, but who cannot yet see the moral imperative of world brotherhood. I would like to see the fervor, the energy of the civil rights movement imbued into the peace movement to instill it with greater strength. And I believe everyone has a duty to be in both the civil rights and the peace movements. But for those who presently choose only one, I would hope that they will finally come to see the moral roots common to both. Okay, so that was a long introduction, and I have written somewhere